From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Pullman, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook.
As women, we have to learn to say no. We have to learn to use our voices, and we have to learn early on to fight for what we believe.
We're bringing you a bonus episode today, a conversation with Deborah Lee, who just recently left her post as the chairman and CEO of BET Networks. My colleague, Politico editor, Carrie Budoff-Brown, interviewed Lee at our first ever Women Rule Summit in Los Angeles this week. It was a really fascinating and candid conversation, where they talked about everything from how Lee got involved in politics to how she transformed BET from a music video channel to a network with critically acclaimed original shows. They also chatted about that one time Lee turned down a Kanye music video for BET and what happened after. Stay tuned for Carrie's interview with Deborah Lee. On the podcast, we'll be bringing you real talk with women bosses, asking how did you make it and what advice would you give a woman looking to lead? If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. Please share our episodes on social media. Follow me on Twitter at @APalmerDC. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. One last thing before we get to the episode. If you didn't get a chance to check out our LA Summit in person, make sure to visit politico.com/womenrule to see what all the hype was about. We talked with a ton of women leaders, from actress Jessica Alba to former Senator Barbara Boxer, and we discussed how women are running, leading, and earning in the world today. And now, Carrie Budoff-Brown and Deborah Lee.
Thank you so much for joining us, Deborah.
Great. Glad to be here. It smells good in here. Is that just, or am I just
well,
hungry?
Good. I think you're hungry.
They're cooking
you know,
lunch.
After this, there. We're going to have a great luncheon.
So yeah.
That
okay.
might be.
You're
so,
getting ready. It's coming
stand
this way. I can smell it. But I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here. I mean, so after 30 years, what is next after BET?
Well, I haven't decided yet, which is an amazing place to be. I've been at BET 32 years, and as Carrie said, I stepped down last week. So I'm still cleaning out my office in LA. I cleaned out my office in New York a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I'm trying to get past the emotion of it because it is very emotional. I grew up in an Army family, so we moved every 2 years. Looking back, you know, the fact that I've done anything for 32 years is pretty incredible. So someone gave me some good advice and said, why don't you close this chapter before you think about the next one? And it's not a real retirement because I don't think I'm that old. I hope
you're not.
Thank you. So I've heard it described as working differently. So I'm very excited about that. So, you know, and everyone tells me to take my time, to don't rush into things, say no for a while, because otherwise you'll fill your plate with things that you may regret later on. I just moved to LA because both of my kids live here, and I knew they were never coming back to Washington, D.C., and it was a good time to leave Washington, D.C. So,
you know,
it all kind of worked.
Yes.
So I'm just kind of, you know, hanging out, I think, at least for the summer, and try to figure out what I want to do next.
To that point, I mean, when I, in planning for this conversation and talking to some of my colleagues at Politico, I said, you know, why hasn't Deborah Lee run for office?
Mm.
And, you know, you look at the resume and you think, So I'll, again, ask the question, so you'll get your one. Is running for political office something, A, that you've ever considered, ever been asked, and now that you have allegedly a lot of free time.
Allegedly.
Yes, allegedly. We never have enough free time.
Right.
Why not a run for office?
Well, you asked me that backstage.
True.
And I said to you, this is the first time anyone's ever asked me that.
Which is remarkable.
And I guess I've never, you know, to be honest, I've really never been interested in running for office. When I went to law school at Harvard, I hated it. And I needed to find a way out because I didn't want to drop out. And I never really wanted to be a lawyer anyway. My father wanted me to be a lawyer. And so my first year of law school, I applied to the Kennedy School of Government. And they had a four-year combined program where you get your master's of public policy in addition to your law degree. So I said, well, this is a good way to give me another career where I may not have to practice law. So I did the joint degree program, and then in 1980, when I graduated, I moved to Washington. But let me back up for a minute. What they teach you at the Kennedy School of Government is how to be a career government executive. And that might last for 18 months because you're appointed by one president and someone else might leave, might win and come in to the White House. But what they train you for is to be assistant secretary of something. Mm-hmm. So that was my goal. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be assistant secretary of something. And I didn't think that I personally would like running an election or raising money or fighting against someone who's running against me. That part of politics didn't appeal to me. So I moved to Washington with the hopes of being, assistant secretary of something. I had accepted a job with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then at the last minute, I got a clerkship, a federal clerkship in D.C., so it was hard to turn that down. Mm-hmm. So I put the SEC job on hold, went and did my clerkship, and during my clerkship, Ronald Reagan won. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to go into a Reagan administration. So I ended up going to a big law firm. The Republicans stayed in office for 12 years, if any of you all are old enough to remember that. And by the time the Democrats came back into office, I was entrenched in my career at BET. Yeah. But to answer your question, I've never really seriously considered running for office. I don't know.
Is there something?
And to add to that, when President Obama won, I worked very hard on his campaign, and I think BET can get some of the credit for helping get him elected. We did a lot of get out the vote campaigns, and even though we're a nonpartisan network, he was on a lot. So when he won, I was in Grant Park that night, and all of a sudden people started saying, well, what are you going to do with the administration? And I said, I can't think of anything I really want to do. I like where I am. Mm-hmm. I want to continue to be supportive of President Obama and his administration, but I think I can do it from where I am. I used to have an office in D.C. I had a nice, view of the Capitol, and I just thought to myself, I'd rather stay here and be an outsider who's supportive. And that's what I did.
Is there anything different about this moment that is causing you at all to rethink that?
No. I think it's...
I think
it's making me more certain I don't want to run for office.
Yeah, it's making you more certain you would?
That I don't want to.
That you don't want
yes.
to. Got it.
Yes. I encourage all of you all
yes.
to run for office. And I would love to be supportive. I don't know. I lost, student government presidents. I lost Miss Dudley High. I've lost enough elections in my life.
Those memories can be scarring.
Yes, they can.
But
I remember them, 50 years later.
I lost the middle school.
Yeah, oh, really?
School. I recovered in high school.
Yeah, okay. In sixth grade, I was elected president of class because I had just moved to Greensboro, North Carolina from L.A. And they thought I was very weird and didn't know any better. And so...
nonetheless, you led BET.
Right.
This is a major thing. I want to talk with you about making change at corporations. Coming in, as an editor at Politico, wanting to make changes, the struggle that you come up against. You led BET through a transformation. When you got there, it was primarily music videos, some criticism internally and externally about the content of those music videos. Offering more original programming. What compelled you to make that change? And more importantly, I think for this audience is what were the challenges you came up against, not just as a change maker, but as a woman who's making change at the head of a corporation?
Wow, I think that's what my book is gonna be about. I mean, there's so many different answers question.
Yeah.
I knew growing up, I grew up in segregated South. I went to all black schools. I lived through the civil rights era, and I was raised that it was important to give back. And so I've always put that out as a goal to give back. I thought I was going to give back by being a civil rights attorney. By the time I graduated from law school, it was kind of too late for that. And as I said, I switched to thinking I was going to do government service. And so when the Republicans won, I went to a big law firm and hid out for 5 years, hoping the Democrats would come back. And after 5 years, it was time for me to decide either I wanted to make partner or I should leave. And luckily, BET was a client. And the founder, Bob Johnson, asked me to come and start the legal department. And I said, that's interesting because, you know, it's in media. I was doing communications law at the time. So I was interested in it. I wanted to go in-house, and that was unusual or hard to do in D.C., and I didn't want to leave D.C. at the time. So I decided to accept the job, and I went and started the legal department. After I got in-house, I found that I started liking the business side. Mm-hmm. And I started doing more business things. I helped build our first studio. I ran our magazine division. And on and on and on till I became chief operating officer and then eventually CEO. So about the time I took over 13 years ago as CEO, networks, cable networks were starting to get more into original programming. And I say that to say BET was no different from Fox, or, well, Fox got there a little faster, but FX or USA Network or MTV or VH1. I mean, we were all trying to find the least expensive way to program a network because we didn't have much revenue coming in at the time. And so after BET went public in 1991, we were the first African-American company to go public on the New York Stock Exchange. We started growing. And when I took over, we started having more revenue. And in the meantime, Viacom acquired us. Mm-hmm. So we had more resources. So I promised, and then when I became CEO, everyone says, well, what's your vision? And I was like, wow, that's an interesting question. No one ever asked me that when I was COO. You know, you just do what you're told. So when I became CEO, I was like, well, I need a vision. And so I said, and I was, you know, certain that this was the way, that BET needed more original programming. One, networks were going international and you needed to own your own product. Two, our audience was demanding it. Our audience was very loyal, and they didn't know why BET should be different from ABC, mm-hmm. NBC, or CBS. They wanted to see original sitcoms, original movies, original dramas. So I said, you know, that's going to be our priority. Yep. And little by little, we got into that space. Later than some cable networks, but earlier than others. You know, our first big step into original programming was The Game, which is a show we took over from...
we got a fan back here.
From the... Yeah, oh, yay, someone liked The Game. We took it over from CW, and when it was on the CW, it got about 1.5 million viewers a night. When we, the first episode we aired that we produced ourselves, after it had been off the air for 2 years, we got 7.7 million viewers.
There you go. Yep.
So that said to me, we're on the right track, it's the right strategy, and our audience will show up if you give them high quality programming. So the next was Being Mary Jane. Then we've done, you know, miniseries like New Edition. We've done movies. And it over and over again, it proves to be true that our audience, African-American consumers, are hungry for images that are realistic. I don't like the words positive or negative, but are realistic. And I knew from growing up, again, in the segregated South, that images were important. I mean, I grew up in awe of Diana Ross and the Supremes and the Temptations and the few black people I saw on television. I remember Julia, okay, I'm really showing my age now, but Julia was a show about a single mm-hmm. black woman. Her husband died and she had a son. She was a nurse and she worked for a white doctor, and that was in the 60s. And I remember that meant something. So the more I got into television and had more resources, it was about what are the stories we want to tell,
I was struck by something that you said in a 2015 interview with the Huffington Post. I'm not sure if you remember. Let's bring it back. When I took the COO position, I found out that two or three guys at my level had already asked for it. There wasn't even a job. So how did they know to ask for it? That just shows the difference between how I was looking at my career and how they were looking at their careers. Right. They were positioning themselves for the next step, and I was just happy being where I was. Now, I like really super identify with that. Like, I'm happy, right? Why do I gotta do anything else? Why do I gotta be, you know? So I would love to hear your thought process, like talk to women in this audience. You know, what would you tell women who are happy where they are and then, you know, the men around them are already going for the next thing? What do women have to do?
And that'll allow me to answer the second part of your question about what some of the challenges were. So that's very true. I did say that. And when I was offered the job, I never, and Bob Johnson was still CEO, and there were about six or seven executives that reported to him. So what happened was he wanted to start thinking about his exit strategy. He said he needed a president and COO, and he offered it to me. And like I said, I didn't know the job existed. I was EVP and general counsel, which to me was the highest level in my profession. You know, as a lawyer, you're not going to get higher than EVP and general counsel. At least that was my thought process. But as I started doing more of the business things, I started enjoying it. And so when I was offered the position, by that time I had like six different jobs. I was publisher of the magazine group. I was the blah, 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 blah. But I couldn't do all of those things and keep up with the law, with the legal profession and changing law. So I was really nervous. Still being, you can't be a general counsel and be your own client. It just doesn't work. So it provided me a way to not be general counsel anymore. But I was the reason I made that comment is the first challenge I had was convincing the executive team that had to work with me all of a sudden that they should support me. Because they were hired by someone else, and some of them had asked for the job and were unhappy they didn't get it. And so I had a team that wasn't really my team. And to be honest, it took me 6 years to change that team. You know,
what did you do to cope with that?
I became a nervous wreck. First thing I did was hire more women. Because I hated going to my own senior team meetings because it was mostly men and there was just testosterone popping all over the walls. And, you know, they wouldn't do what I asked. I was trying to be, you know, manage in a different way. So I was like, oh, it'd be nice if we, no, that didn't work. So, you know, and I found I had to be very direct. I was like, do this. Or you will lose your job, right? Do this or you will lose your job. And the bad part is when I was put in that position, the first thing the CEO told them was, oh, don't worry, she can't fire you. Well, you can't manage anyone if they think you have no control over their future. So I had to change that dictate. I had to hire more women, so the room was a little more friendly. And I got much more direct in terms of my orders. I had to change my management style. It was not a consensus building atmosphere at the time. So that was the biggest challenge, how to manage men who weren't in my corner. Mm-hmm. And it, like I said, I couldn't fire everyone at once. So it took me little by little, and people left on their own. But once I had my own team, whether it's men or women that were committed to me, it was a lot easier. But one of the other challenges I had, to your point, was this issue, and you touched on it, about music videos. After the Don Imus incident, where he made negative remarks about the
women basketball players
at Rutgers. You know, his defense was, well, hip-hop artists say bitch all the time. So why are you all coming after me? So that kind of made it, he tried to turn it into a hip-hop issue. And so there was a lot of criticism then. And hip-hop was, you know, it needed criticism. You know, their images of women weren't what we would like. So anyway, in the midst of all that, we had a standards and practices committee at the company, which would make decisions on which videos to air and which ones not to. What a minister in only Maryland decided he didn't like hip-hop videos, and he was going to bus his congregation to my house every Saturday. This went on for 7 months.
Wow.
From 1 to 4 p.m. in the afternoon, just around the time you want to take a nap on Saturday afternoon. And he had his congregation out there with signs saying, "I am not a bitch, I am not a hoe." Hoe. And it kind of upset my neighbors, and it was not pleasant.
How did it affect you?
You know, it affected me because, as I said, I always wanted to give back and do something for my community. So the fact that there was a segment of my community that thought I was doing something wrong really made me sit back and think, okay, should I be programming BET differently? You know, how do I get to that place? And I'm a lawyer, so I'm a believer in First Amendment. So on one hand, you know, I'm into free speech, but on the other hand, I realize I have the ultimate say what goes on BET, and I'm ultimately responsible for it. So the first thing I did was start rejecting more videos, and I rejected a Kanye video, I'll never forget. And my team was like, "Oh, you can't do that, it's Kanye, it's, you know, he's a genius." I said, "But you know, this video is all sex and nudity, and I'm gonna just reject it." They're like, "Well, he's gonna call you." And I was like, "Okay." And so I took a hard stand.
Did he call you?
He never called me. And that made me realize these young people, the artists, they want an adult in the room. They want someone to tell them, "Okay, you've gone too far." And so he put it out on line. He probably, MTV may have played it, I don't know. I realize artists have other venues to get their music out. So I didn't feel as compelled to say, "Well, we're the only outlet." Long story short, when I took over, we were 60% music videos. Today, we have zero. So, you know, and that was part of systematically changing the programming and giving our audience different images. Because if you have a variety of images, maybe that one video doesn't bother you so much. But if that's all you have, and 60% of your programming is music videos, you know, I understand why parents have an issue with that.
Do you think if the past 13 years or where BET is today would be materially different if there had been a man in charge over the last decade plus?
Wow. That's a really good question. And I don't know the answer to that, but I would proffer that it probably would be different. And I had to realize early in my tenure that because I am a black woman, it should be different. It should be different. You know, at first I said, "Oh, I'm gonna just be a manager and it's all about the numbers." But if if you're committed to an audience and you have values, you know, you want to bring those values to work with you. And if you can't bring them to work with you, you're going to be unhappy. And that's what happened as a result of those protests. My team and I went through this rebranding strategy, and that's what we found out. And we decided our values were to respect, reflect, and elevate our audience. And if that wasn't part of the program or the campaign or whatever it was, we wouldn't do it. And that's what distinguishes us to this day, I think, from other networks that are going after the black audience. And I'm proud of that. And I think, you know, my values and what I'm committed to is a part of that. And I must say, we have a lot of shows that have strong black women as the main character. I'm not sure a man would have done that. But, you know, maybe. I hate to generalize across the board. But when I look back on shows that were created during my tenure, like Black Girls Rock or Being Mary Jane, or even we have a show on now called In Contempt, which is about a black female lawyer, you know, they speak to me as well as to our audience, which is 65% women.
There you go.
Yeah. So
I want to close. I mean, I could probably talk with you for an hour, but we've already run over, and I think you have another appointment to get to. I just would love to end. If you could share one major lesson that you learned reflecting that you would leave with this audience, leadership, survival, getting ahead, like, you know, single best piece of advice to women here.
Yeah. Well, I think that the past 18 months have been game-changing as far as women and how we have historically not been heard. And I hope the one thing that comes out of the Harvey Weinstein case and the Time's Up movement and Me Too is that women and girls find their voices much earlier. You know, I think historically, and again, I hate to generalize, but I think historically, you know, we're people pleasers. You know, we want to make everyone happy. And I see that even in management, and I saw it in my management style. You know, I wanted to be the judge. I wanted to hear from this person and that person, and then make the ultimate decision. You don't have time for that in the business world. You really don't. And you have to make some people unhappy, and you have to say no a lot. I think I heard the last panel talking about saying yes and no. And I remember I came home from work one day, and my daughter, who was much younger at the time, said, you know, how was your day? And I was like, it was really hard. I felt like all I did was say no. No to budget requests, no to charitable contributions, no to, you know, whatever. And my daughter thought about it, and then a couple of months later, someone asked her what she wanted to be, and she said she wanted to be CEO of BET when she grew up. And I was like, where did that come from? You've never said that before. And she looked at me and she said, I like saying no. So I think we have to, I think, as women, we have to learn to say no. We have to learn to use our voices. And we have to learn early on to fight for what we believe, even if that means you don't get that next promotion or, you know, you're unpopular at work, God forbid. You know, you have to learn to speak up and have your voice heard. And, you know, it's hard. I see in rooms of teams now where, it happened to me the other day in a boardroom. I was saying something, and one of the men on the board interrupted me midstream and just took it. And so when he finished, I said, well, as I was saying before I was interrupted, and I finished my point. But, I mean, did he get it? He did after I said that, but when he did it, he didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do it on purpose. He just was so thinking about what he wanted to say. And I don't know if he thought what I was saying wasn't as important as what he was gonna say, but it still happens to us. And this is a board with three or four women. It still happens, and we have to not let it happen. And we have to not sit in rooms and be quiet, either because we're afraid to speak up or, you know, we're afraid we have the wrong answer. I mean, we have to learn to speak up and not stand for abuse and harassment and all the other things that we're hearing about these days. I mean, it breaks my heart to hear these stories from grown women of how they were abused when they were teenagers and they didn't know any better. So anyway, I don't mean to get into all of that, but it comes to the point that you have to believe in yourself, you have to believe in your values, and you have to believe in your opinions. And if we all do that, I think this will be a much better world.
Women Rule is produced by Rena Flores. Dave Shaw is our executive producer, and our booker is Jessica Andrews. If you're a fan of the show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. So hit that subscribe button, and thanks for listening.